Barker, Barnhart, Berger, Beyer, Bonamici, Boone, Boquist, Bruin, Buckley, Burley, Butler, Cameron, Cannon, Clem, Cowan, Dallum, Dingfelder, Chris Edwards, David Edwards, Esquivel, Flores, Galizio, Gerard, Gelzer, Gilliam, Gilman, Gerard, Greenlick, Hannah, Holvey, Hunt, Jensen, Comp, Kotek, Krieger, Crummel, Lim, McPherson, Maurer, Minnis, Morgan, Nathanson, Nelson, Nolan, Olson, Reed, Richardson, Riley, Roblin, Rosenbaum, Schaffler, Scott, Shields, Greg Smith, Patty Smith, Thatcher, Tomei, Wisnet, Witt, Mr. Speaker, Excused, Boone, Esquivel, and Patty Smith.
Flag salute will be led by Representative Tina Kotek.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
The opening ceremony in honor of National Poetry Month will be presented by Lex Runciman of McMinnville, reading a poem, and a guest of Representative Carolyn Tomei.
Please be seated. I want to thank you all for the honor of being here this morning. I think that legislators and writers have something essential in common. We want language to convey our meanings. Sometimes it's surprising how difficult this turns out to be. We can think and imagine in ways that feel deeply convincing, maybe even almost perfect, and then somehow the words don't quite match up. This is a poem called One Thing, and the garden mentioned in the first line is the Garden of Eden. In the garden, before everything fell into its separateness, before everything fell apart, the mute and noisy world sang. It was one thing, and we had no need for speech. Pears and the mayfly hatch were one thing, and plums withering and olives littering the floor were one thing. And what the spider said spinning, what slugs intoned, what onions in their harmonies grew, what a kestrel's eye understood and the mosquitoes knew, and what leeches and eels contemplated in their solitude was one thing. The arc of the sun rising and Venus rising, and the moon's peering at us with its rheumy eye, and papyrus in the backwash, the kelp forest, and the swoop of bats and their dreamless sleep, and the open mouths of poppies and sand dunes, a drift of camas, a cane thicket, jackrabbits and purple vetch, a stand of wheat or mustard or daisies, a horse with its nostrils flared to the wind, was one thing. Afterwards, for our consolation and despair, our guessing and second guessing, our anger and stammer and painful joy, we had to learn to speak, to learn how clumsy we had become, and wrong, foolish, arrogant, partial, and loud. It's all we can do to think the world we breathe in, the chant and rhythm of it, catching the unsayable shape and echo, which was one thing. Speech and silence, certainty and doubt, the wakefulness and the sleeping, the error and the remedy. If there are lessons here, I suppose they have to do with patience and listening, and when necessary, trying again. As a writer, I sympathize with your aims. As an Oregonian, I want to thank you for your service. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Runciman. Appreciated that. Courtesies, Representative Greenlick.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. We have in the gallery today a number of advocates for public health. This is Public Health Week, and we've been working very hard in this session. We have a whole number of bills. We've had the Health Policy Commission yesterday producing a report on what we can do statewide on child obesity, and we have about five or six bills that these advocates have been helping us work on, and I really congratulate them. I hope you'll extend to them all the courtesies of the House. As a member of the Health Policy Commission and chair of the Health Care Committee, I look forward to working with my public health colleagues to ensure that this legislative session we take action to improve the public's health for the good of all Oregonians. And I urge you, if you have a few minutes, to stop and talk to them about what we can all do for the public health of our state.
Further courtesies, Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, please extend courtesies today to Lex Runciman, who is our guest in honor of National Poetry Month. Lex is the husband of my great legislative aide, Debbie Runciman. Lex was born and raised in Portland and is currently professor of English at Linfield College. He is the author of three poetry collections, including The Admirations, which won the Oregon Book Award in 1989. His most recent collection, Out of Town, appeared in the Northwest Poets series from Cloud Bank Books. The poem he read this morning is from that beautiful collection. At Linfield, he teaches American literature and creative writing, and his students are currently reading Wallace Stegner's novel, Angle of Repose, which is one of my very favorite books. He has received the Edith Green Distinguished Professor Award in 1998, and he regularly leads Linfield students during a month-long creative writing travel course in the United Kingdom. Thank you, Lex, for coming today, and thank you for reading from your beautiful poetry collection.
Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I'd like your help in welcoming two dedicated civic tourists to visit Oregon today. Michelle and Brian Tolby are friends of ours from Modesto, California, and they're visiting Oregon as part of their quest to visit all 50 state capitals. We're number 14 on their list, and hopefully we can make it a memorable one. Thank you.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, please join me in extending a warm welcome to Jeff Bishop. He's standing up here on the aisle. He is the executive director of the Oregon International Port of Coos Bay and one of the primary leaders rebuilding our South Coast economy. Jeff was appointed by Governor Kulongoski and leads a team of 40. You should have a short statement on your desk about him. He's here today because he believes in funding for Southwestern Oregon Community College, critical to local economic development efforts. South Coast has for years endured economic hardship due to a collapse of the timber and fishing industries. Jeff and a group of other community leaders has been redefining its identity to focus on sustainable industries. Among their projects to bring family-wage jobs to South Coast is a liquefied natural gas terminal on the North Spit and related pipeline and an international container shipping terminal. The projects are expected to generate thousands of family-wage jobs and millions of dollars for our economy. Without the $529 million state investment in community colleges, it would be difficult, if not impossible, to train the local workforce for the new jobs required for a successful port development. Without it, there is no recovery from decades of recessionary economics. Please extend the courtesies of the chamber to Jeff Bishop and his partners from Southwestern Oregon Community College visiting here today. Thank you.
Welcome. Representative Brune.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, please join me in welcoming one of our honorary pages today, Austin Bryan. Austin, stand up. I just had the pleasure of meeting Austin just a short time ago, and I have to say he is an incredibly articulate and polite young man. It's great to have you here today, Austin. Austin lives in Tualatin. He is 13 years old and in seventh grade. He is homeschooled and also attends Village Homeschool for extracurricular other classes. School activities include history, Lego robotics, and fencing, and his career goals include political science, some sort of career in history, or even a lawyer. Austin, it's great to have you here today. Welcome.
Further courtesies. I'd like to ask the students from Park Row Sacramento Elementary to stand who are up in the balcony. These students are with us today. They're fourth graders, and they are sponsored by teacher Jerry Landreth. It is a delight to have all of you with us. Thank you. I'd like to note we do have some additional pages with us, and specifically honorary page Drew Gingrich. Drew, if you could stand. It's a delight to have you with us. Okay, and so thank you very much. Drew, by the way, is a guest of Representative Chip Shields, I believe. Messages from the governor. Messages from the Senate.
Mr. Speaker, I'm directed by the President from the Senate to pass Senate Bill 5546, Senate Bill 3685, 144, 880, House Bills 2444, 2266, 5011, 5034, 5045, 5049, 5052, 2076, 2265, 2274, 2111, 5043, 2109, 2348. Mr. Speaker, I'm directed by the President from that he has signed Senate Bill 42 and 307.
First reading, memorials and resolutions. Standing committee reports. The committee report file has been distributed. Special committee reports. Special orders of business. The chair requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended for immediate second and third reading and final consideration of House Bill 3532. Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. The chair requests unanimous consent to temporarily advance the order of business of second reading of House bills. Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. The clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 3532 relating to county assessment function funding assistance payments and declaring an emergency.
Bill read second time is passed the third reading. The House is now under the order of business of special orders. The clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 3532 relating to county assessment function funding assistance payments and declaring an emergency.
Question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 3532A. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your Committee on Revenue brings House Bill 3532 with a unanimous do-pass recommendation. This bill is one of the series of bills that the legislature has and will consider concerning the county funding issue, and it relates to a complex problem involving the funding for county assessors. Under the County Assessment and Taxation Fund, otherwise known as CAFA, the counties collect as part of the recording fees a sum of funds, money which is deposited with the Department of Revenue and then redistributed to the counties for the purpose of assisting in the assessment process, which of course includes assessing properties and collecting taxes and the other things that are involved in the assessor's office. The distribution of those funds is based upon the county's effort to maintain the budgets of those offices. The purpose of this bill is to allow a temporary reduction in the standard that allows the distribution of those funds. And the point of it is that we're concerned about the possibility of reductions in county budgets as a result of the loss of timber revenue from the federal government. And this bill would allow for 1 year only a reduction in the county effort and still allow for the distribution of the CAFA funds to those counties by the Department of Revenue. Otherwise, the Department of Revenue would have no choice but to cut those counties off from the distribution of these funds, which in many cases pay a substantial portion of the assessment department's expenses, resulting, of course, in a spiral down for those counties. The funds would then be redistributed to the other counties who, frankly, have less need of the money. I urge your I-vote on this bill as a means of assisting those counties that may face an economic emergency this year. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Barnhart, do you wish to close?
Thank you, no.
Those who are of the opinion the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Dallum, how do you vote? Representative Dallum was off the floor. Sorry. Representative Crummell, how do you vote? Crummell votes aye. House Bill 3532A, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Propositions and motions. First reading of House bills.
House Bill 3227 relating to insanity.
Bill read first time is passed the Speaker's desk for referral. Second reading of House bills.
House Bill 2910 relating to elections.
Bills read second time or passed the third reading. Consent calendar. Clerk will read the first bill in summary.
Senate Bill 84 relating to correction of erroneous material in Oregon law makes non-substantive and technical changes to Oregon law, corrects grammar and punctuation, deletes obsolete provisions, conforms language to existing statutes and legislative style.
Question now arises upon third reading and final passage of Senate Bill 84A. Those who are of the opinion the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. And the clerk will open the voting system. Representative Boquist, how do you vote? Boquist votes aye. Representative Beyer, how do you vote? Representative Beyer, how do you vote? Beyer votes aye. Representative Gelser votes aye. Representative Minnis votes aye. Representative Jensen, how do you vote? Votes aye. And Representative Dallum votes aye. Senate Bill 84A, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk, read the next bill.
Senate Bill 147, related to Board of Medical Examiners for the State of Oregon, changes name of Board of Medical Examiners for the State of Oregon to Oregon Medical Board.
Question now arises on third reading and final passage of Senate Bill 147. Those who are opinion the bill should pass, vote aye. Those opposed, no. And the clerk will open the voting system. Representative Lim, how do you vote? Lim votes aye. Representative Berger, how do you vote? Votes aye. Senate Bill 147, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk, read the next bill in summary.
Senate Bill 223, relating to exemption from weight limitations for vehicles with idle reduction systems and declaring an emergency, allows certain vehicles to exceed weight limitations when a vehicle is equipped with idle reduction systems.
Question now arises upon third reading and final passage of Senate Bill 223. Those who have the opinion the bill should pass, vote aye. Those opposed, no. And the clerk will open the voting system. Representative, nope, you voted. Everyone's voted. Senate Bill 223, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk, read the next bill in summary.
Senate Bill 224, relating to railroad inspector qualifications, repeals statute requiring qualifications of railroad inspectors.
Question now arises upon third reading and final passage of Senate Bill 224. Those of the opinion the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. And the clerk will open the voting system. Representative Boquist, how do you vote? Boquist votes aye. Representative Nathanson, how do you vote? Votes aye. Representative Rosenbaum votes aye. Senate Bill 224, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk, read the next bill in summary.
Senate Bill 230, relating to authority of State Board of Psychologist Examiners, eliminates authority of State Board of Psychologist Examiners to deny renewal of a license for failure to complete or provide documentation of previous completion of required plan management education program prior to payment of required renewal fee.
Question now arises upon third reading and final passage of Senate Bill 230. Those of the opinion the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. And the clerk will open the voting system. Representative Chris Edwards, how do you vote? Representative Chris Edwards, how do you vote? Votes aye. Representative Phil Barnhart, votes aye. Representative Gelser, votes aye. Senate Bill 230, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Third reading of House bills. Clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 5040, relating to financial administration for the public employees retirement system, declaring an emergency.
Question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 5040A. Representative Galizio.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, House Bill 5040 is the budget bill for the Public Employee Retirement System, or PERS. PERS administers the retirement plans that cover most of Oregon's public employees. It also administers health plans for qualified retirees that wish to enroll in and pay for such plans. PERS is still dealing with workload issues resulting from the 2003 reform legislation and subsequent lawsuits. The Joint Committee on Ways and Means has provided funding to continue addressing that workload. It also provided funding to continue the conversion of the aging existing retirement information management system to the new system that was installed for the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan. The conversion is scheduled for completion November 2009. Additionally, most of the work resulting from the reform legislation and lawsuits should be completed by the end of the upcoming biennium. PERS will report to the legislature on its progress in the first and third quarters of calendar 2008. The committee reduced the budget to recognize efficiency savings of about $1.2 million and reinvested a portion of that for improved retirement application support. Stakeholders and PERS identified the need for additional support in this area. Upfront efforts to ensure complete and accurate retirement information applications should result in more timely processing of benefit payments and reduce costs associated with redoing and reworking applications. Improved customer satisfaction should also result. The committee also reviewed the agency's performance measures. We rolled number 8 into number 6 to have one key measure for customer satisfaction. The committee approved the 8 measures included in the budget report. The Joint Committee on Ways and Means recommends approval of House Bill 5040A.
Further discussion, Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Question of the carrier.
Question of the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
He does.
He does.
Good representative, we appreciate all the work that goes into this. It's very complicated. I was wondering if you have in your materials the number of retirees that retired from PERS in 2003, 2004, 2005, so that we can get an idea of the trend?
Yes, thank you, and you've been kind enough to alert me to your concerns. I would say one thing to point out, as is clear, 2003, there was a peak of 12,488 retirees. Subsequently, in 2004, we had about 6,000, and 2005, almost 5,000, and then 4,500 in 2006. However, it was made clear by PERS that the number of retirees, basically because of demographics, is now on the increase. So the estimate is for 2007 and beyond is about 5,500 to 6,000-plus retirees.
Thank you. Follow-up question?
Additional question, Mr. Carrier yield?
He does.
He does.
If I could direct your attention to your materials on the number of PERS employees, would you mind also sharing with us the number of employees that PERS had in 2003 and 2004? And just and actually for the 4 years, if you would, I want to also show the trend there, 03, 04, 05, and 06.
The number of positions?
Positions.
Sure. 2003, 334. 2004, 418. 2005, 389. 2006, 414. And 2007, 401.
Okay. Final question, the carrier.
Yes. Additional question. Does carrier yield?
He does.
Would you also share with us the number of vacancies during those same years that the positions that PERS had funded by this body but had been left vacant?
Sure. 2003, there were 66. 2004, there were 86. 2005, there were 52. 2006, there were 60. And as of March 2007, there were about 49. And I would add to this just kind of a preface, something that was very important in the discussions that we had in the Ways and Means Committee is the legislature has consistently funded limited duration positions. In fact, over 100 limited duration positions for PERS to deal with the enormous workload from the demographic shifts to the lawsuit, the Strunk Eugene position. And as what happens with limited duration, if someone's in a limited duration position and they see that there's a permanent position somewhere else, they grab it. So that's why there have been some vacancies. So.
Thank you. To the bill.
To the bill.
Mr. Speaker and colleagues, the reason that I bring this information out is when we went through the PERS reform process in 2003, we were at a time of great transition, and a number of laws were passed that affected PERS, and my recollection is that we added over nearly 100 positions, well, a substantial number of positions as a result of the legislation that took place and the implementation of PERS Tier 3, which is called OPSWERP, the new PERS plan for new employees. As a result of what was taking place in PERS, there were substantial numbers of retirees. We're talking about 12,488 retirees in 1 year. Presently, in 05, it was 4,559, and now it's estimated that next year it'll be 5,500. Well, 5,500 is less than half of what it was during this huge buildup in PERS to deal with this bubble. And at the time that, since then, you know, we allocated these additional positions, there's been vacancies that have averaged 62 positions a year. Now, what vacancies mean is, you know, we fund, say we fund 400 employees, and if there's only 400 or 330 employees that they're actually paying salaries for, the money is still there for the extra 70 employees. It's in their budget, and it gets utilized elsewhere. And we need to be very careful in each of the departments to watch closely the number of filled positions versus the number of authorized positions, because the difference is money that becomes essentially miscellaneous funds that can be utilized elsewhere. I brought this up to a president of one of the universities, and she said, "Oh, don't mess with our unfunded vacancies don't mess with our vacancies because that's the money that we use to keep everything rolling." And so you end up having approval for X number, and you're funding this number, but if they're only filling some lesser number, it just gives extra money to use as they see fit, and it's essentially off budget. And so we're looking at a request today in this bill for 21 increased positions. And so if we take a look and we see that for 05-07, and this is on page 205 of our summary, it says that the authorized positions was 380. And that the governor's budget requested 403, but the co-chairs cut that by two positions and is only requesting authorization for 401, which is 20 full-time or authorized positions, 21 positions more than what is currently authorized at a time when over the last 5 years they've had an average of 62 positions that have been funded but vacant. And so maybe as this body watches out for the well-being of PERS recipients and how their money is being utilized, maybe we'd be wise to ask the question, do we want to approve a budget that's going to increase the number of funded positions by 21 when over the last 5 years there's been an average vacancy rate of 62 positions, and presently they have 49 positions that are vacant. Why would we want to increase funding for 21 new positions when there's 49 positions that are sitting there empty, that are generating money for their utilization, but not where we're approving it? And so it's incumbent upon us to watch out in each of these budgets to assure that the money is being well spent, because we're authorizing it. And certainly we could say, well, this is not tax money, it's not general fund money, but it kind of is, because we approve the funds for a school district, and then the school district has to pay into PERS, and then PERS administers the program with the money that they get. And so while it looks like it's other funds, this is money that is not going to PERS accounts and is not being utilized elsewhere where it could be more carefully and more essentially needed. And so based on this information, I would hope that we would reconsider this budget and send it back with a no vote, because we should not be authorizing 21 new positions when they got 49 vacancies presently and they haven't been fully staffed in 5 years. Thank you.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Galizio, do you wish to close?
I do.
Please.
I appreciate the analysis of the representative from Southern Oregon. Just to provide a little bit more of context, and I wish he'd been able to join us in the hearings, and I think there would be a little bit more context. Number one, in terms of the numbers of positions, again, 100 of those 401 positions that he mentioned are limited duration, and they disappear at the end of the 07-09, so it'll drop down to about 300. Also, in terms of costs, absent the vacancy savings that PERS had, they would have had to have come to the e-board, and money was redirected for legal costs dealing with the Strunk Eugene, systems development costs, and money had to be redirected to IT support and other external costs to deal with the post-Strunk Eugene decision. So, colleagues, I would argue strongly that the agency has done quite well. Everyone on the committee was very impressed at their management, and I would urge you to support this budget.
Those who are of the opinion that the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. And the clerk will open the voting system. Representative Riley, how do you vote? Riley votes no. Representative Wisnett votes no. Representative Olson, how do you vote? Votes no. Representative Gilman votes no. Representative Grard votes no. Representative Crummell, how do you vote? Representative Crummell votes aye. Those House Bill 5040A, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk, read the next bill.
House Bill 2345, relating to dogs.
Question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 2345A. Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. House Bill 2345 comes to you from the Judiciary Committee by unanimous vote. You have on your desk today a picture of Sarah Weidenhoff, a constituent of mine. As you can see, she has suffered a severe dog bite. She has had 5 operations and will need at least 2 more. Her medical expenses and losses are over $70,000. If this had happened to a child or a middle-class income family, how could they afford these costs? In recent years, we have seen an increase in incidents of dog bites involving large dogs of certain breeds. From 1979 to 1999, dog attacks resulted in more than 300 human dog bite fatalities in the United States. Most of these victims were children. House Bill 2345 provides that a dog owner in a civil action for medical expenses arising from an injury caused by a dog may not raise as a defense that the owner could not foresee that the dog would cause the injury. The bill clarifies that if a plaintiff need not establish foreseeability in action arising from injury caused by a dog. 35 states now have moved to holding owners of dogs to be responsible for the first bite. Passing of this bill cannot help Sarah, but she hopes that the passage of this bill will protect children and others who are victims of dog bites from extreme medical expenses she and her family have experienced. It's interesting to note that the bill was not opposed by the Humane Society. It's a good bill, protects children and families. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, many of the bills that we consider in this chamber arouse intense passions of the moment, but they're, I think, probably forgotten to most of us and certainly to the broader public in a few years, maybe a few months, maybe even a few days. This bill is actually a significant bill in its reflection of sort of a broad change in what's happening in the society that we serve. There was a common law rule that said, was summarized with the phrase, every dog gets one free bite. And it originated in rural England, where dogs were companion animals, but they were also working animals, and they ran generally at, loose in the neighborhood. And there was an expectation of tolerance for what those dogs might do upon some occasions. And it was only after a dog had proven by having bitten someone that his or her propensity to violence was foreseeable, that a claim could be brought against the owner. That common law rule has been changed, as the good representative from Southwest Oregon described, in 35 other states. We are now among a minority of states that still hold to that common law rule that requires foreseeability before a lawsuit can be brought against a dog owner. We now live in a less rural society. We live in communities, many of us, where there are leash laws, where there's an expectation that dogs will be more confined. And I think that we need to get with that, join the modern trend in this area of the law by extending legal protection to Oregonians who are injured, some of them rather seriously, by dogs, even where there hasn't been a pattern of that dog biting somebody in the past. So I think it's an important bill, and I really want to thank the representative from Southwest Oregon for bringing it forward, and I urge your aye vote.
Further discussion, Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Sarah is a friend. Her son went to my high school.
To the bill.
To the bill, thank you. And I have watched her go through this experience. She also talked to me. We had another bill, and I think that Representative Krieger's bill addresses the issues really well. I think this is one of those bills, as Representative McPherson has already addressed, that will ensure the protection of our citizens and children around our state. And I think it is the responsibility of pet owners to control their animals, and this is a good bill, should pass.
Further discussion, Representative Berger.
Thank you. To the bill.
To the bill.
My friends, I'm about to make the most dangerous political statement ever heard on this floor. I don't like dogs. And the reason I don't like dogs is, as a child, I was bitten by a dog, unprovoked, walked up. I thought it was a friendly little cute animal until it was in my face, tearing my lip off. And you carry that with you for a lifetime. You guys who have dogs, you look at them, oh, aren't they cute? You know, they're armless, they're nice, they're sweet, they're part of my life. I see teeth and claws every time I look at a dog. And I applaud this bill, wish I'd done it myself. Thank the proponents for bringing it forward. And the reason I stood up to speak today is because We have in our floor letter a pretty graphic example of what a dog can do. But don't think for a minute that that's what this bill is about. This happens hundreds of times a day to people. They get bit by a dog, and the dog gets a pass. And I think that is very unfair. My niece has had an unprovoked dog attack. I can name a lot of people who have unprovoked dog attacks, and it may be a small injury, but it's not a small injury to the person who was minding their own business and had somebody's pet attack them. So please, this is an important bill. It's time for us people who see claws and teeth to be able to stand up and say, the dog doesn't get two bites at me. Once they attack, they are known as a dangerous dog, and you have a way of going into court and doing something about it. Thank you.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Krieger, do you wish to close?
Only very briefly, I want to make sure people understand that this section, as it says in the bill, doesn't prevent the dog owner from affirming a defense that the dog was startled, that it was provoked, or some other manner. But this is a good bill, folks, and I'd like to have your support. Thank you.
Those who are of the opinion the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. And the clerk will open the voting system. Representative Kotak, how do you vote? Representative Kotak votes aye. Representative Thatcher has voted. House Bill 2345A, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk, read the next bill.
House Bill 2386, relating to physical therapy.
Question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 2386A. Representative Bruin.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, House Bill 2386 comes unanimously from your House Committee on Health Care and was brought forward by the Oregon Physical Therapy Association. House Bill 2386 clarifies the use of the term doctor in regard to physical therapists. It will clear up any confusion consumers may have by allowing physical therapists who have received a doctorate degree, a doctoral degree in physical therapy, to use the term doctor of physical therapy, that designation, when advertising or in professional notices. HB 2386 would also increase the number of days that a patient may see a physical therapist directly. Since 1994, patients have been able to have direct access to physical therapy services by a licensed physical therapist for up to 30 days. 2386 would allow 15 additional days for a total of 45 days. As of 2006, direct access is allowed in 43 states across the U.S. and has been shown to save consumers both dollars and time by eliminating the burden of unnecessary physician visits. Many of these patients are paying for services out of pocket. Mr. Speaker, this bill protects patients and helps physical therapists practice their profession in a responsible manner. I appreciate your aye vote.
Further discussion, Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, House Bill 2386 was brought forward at the request of the Oregon Physical Therapy Association. This bill represents extensive work and compromise and had several public hearings prior to the adoption of the Dash 6 amendments. The language in the A and Gross version of the bill was passed unanimously out of committee, and there was no opposition voiced on the bill as amended. This bill would benefit the patients of physical therapists by allowing those patients to have extended access to physical therapy services directly for 45 days. The current 30-day limitation on a patient's ability to receive physical therapy services requires many patients to make unnecessary trips back to their physician. Significant delays in physician appointments affect access to needed physical therapy services, which can become problematic in ensuring that the best outcomes are for that patient. House Bill 2386 would also add physical therapists to the list of 9 other healthcare professionals who are already listed in ORS 676.110. The statute provides guidance to healthcare professionals who use the term doctor by requiring them to indicate their professional designation after their name. In recent years, the degree requirements for many physical therapy programs, including the program offered in Oregon at Pacific University, have increased degree requirements in order to become accredited to offer a doctor of physical therapy degree. The language in House Bill 2386 would require those physical therapists who have received a Doctor of Physical Therapy degree and who wish to use the term doctor to specify their professional designation. Again, this bill represents hard work and much compromise, and I urge your support of House Bill 2386A. Thank you, colleagues.
Further discussion, Representative Greenlink.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
I just want to commend all the folks that worked on this. This really did take a lot of compromise and a lot of hard work among the parties. We came up finally with a consensus bill to which there was basically no disagreement. I urge your support of this bill, and as I say, I commend the parties who were willing to work on it and to compromise.
Further discussion? Seeing none. Representative Bruin, do you wish to close? He does not. Those of your opinion the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. And the clerk will open the voting system. Representative Bruin, how do you vote? He votes aye. Carrier votes aye. Representative Flores votes aye. House Bill 2386A, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk, read the next bill.
House Bill 2538, relating to landscape contractor continuing education, declaring an emergency.
Question now arises on third reading and final passage of House Bill 2538. Representative Shuffler.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. House Bill 2538 authorizes the Landscape Contractors Board to establish continuing education requirements for landscape contractor licensees. Currently, once an individual successfully passes the competency exam to be licensed with the board, there are no requirements for continuing education, in essence a lifetime license, even though technology in the industry is constantly changing. Examples of education needs that have emerged over the past few years include human resources, environmental protection, water management and conservation, and proper use and non-use of chemicals. House Bill 2538 would require landscape contractors to obtain up to 10 hours of continuing education units per year. Under the measure, the board is responsible for approving continuing education programs. The required amount of continuing education hours or units a landscape contractor is required to obtain, and how many hours can be credited to an approved program. Examples of approved programs can go beyond a traditional course at a local community college or university, including attending trade shows and industry meetings or taking advantage of online training. The measure also allows the board to approve waivers for those licensees who cannot complete the established continuing education requirements due to circumstances such as military service, inactive status, or extreme hardship. Requiring continuing education for landscape contractors benefits everyone. Relying on a volunteer system for education will not serve either well. There are many other industries that already require continuing education and benefit from it. Furthermore, House Bill 2538 enhances consumer and environmental protection and increasing the level of professionalism for the landscape contracting industry. Supporters of the bill include Landscape Contractors Board, Oregon Landscape Contractors Association, Association of Professional Landscape Designers, Association of Northwest Landscape Designers, Central Oregon Cities Organization, Regional Water Providers Consortium, Portland Water Bureau, and the Eugene Water and Electric Board. I know there's some concern about our adding onto the burden of business in this state, but I just want to give you an example. My wife is probably the most intelligent person I've ever had the delight to meet, and she has a four-year undergraduate degree in education and health. She got her dental hygiene certificate at Mount Hood, a community college. She got her dental degree at OHSU, every year she takes way more than the required amount of continuing education. It's helped her. It's helped her business. It's helped her in her ability to provide her service to her patients. And she actually looks forward to this kind of education. This bill will not hamper small business. It will not hurt small business. Even the people that testified in opposition to this bill said they're already doing it. It will be very, very easy for them to comply with this minimal amount of continuing education. And in light of the fact that we are so hyper, and rightfully so hyper, concerned about water, water quality, what kind of chemicals are applied and how they're applied and who's applying them, drainage on our property, these folks tie into our structures with decks. There's a long, exhaustive list of things these folks have to keep up on, constantly changing statutes, the tax code, safety rules, a long list these folks have to keep up with. This is information these folks have to be kept up on. This is a good bill, should pass. I urge your aye vote. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Berger.
Thank you. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, I've been frequently asked about my no vote about this in committee. I wholeheartedly agree that continuing education for the wife of the good representative from Happy Valley is absolutely appropriate. She's in a health profession. I think every one of us as consumers wants very much to know that our health professionals and those that we depend on for public safety and any number of things want to be assured that the professionals continue their education. What we're talking about here are landscape contractors. I'm not feeling particularly threatened as a consumer as to what happens in my lawn and yard. There is nothing in this bill that particularly says that they have to take something on pesticide use. They just have to take 10 hours. It could be in anything. It could be given by an industry group, and it counts. I think it's more regulation than we need for an industry that I appreciate, and I'm not really complaining that they want to improve their image and improve sort of how they view themselves. I just think that in this case, there is nothing that particularly helps the consumers. It does add regulation. And this is a situation where let the buyer beware. If you're not aware of who's doing your yard and doing your lawns and putting in your landscaping, then you're a fool for not doing better research. This won't particularly help you. Just because they've had 10 hours of continuing education doesn't mean it's in any of the things that you're hiring them to do. It's more regulation than I'm comfortable with, although I'm not going to die on my sword over this bill. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill. A good representative. I will die on my sword over it just in case. Colleagues, I wholeheartedly agree with the representative from Happy Valley, and he and I have already had this discussion. Continuing education has its merits in pesticide reporting issues, and there are some issues that even the good representative to my right that we might disagree on what ought to and what should not be done. My concern is an access to continuing education, and that was the concern that was raised by the 80% of the licensed contractors who were not represented on this bill. And the reason I raise it up, there are 2,700 licensed contractors that the board licensed. About 20% of those are members of the various associations. My concern, and to the good credit of the representative from Happy Valley, tried to make it very clear in the committee that there needed to be a broad continuum of possible education. But my concern comes back to the bill itself and why I oppose it, and that is that there are four areas of suggestions, A through D on the first page, which outline the types of continuing education the board should consider. My problem is that two of the four are from the professional association, and in order for someone to get assistance from the professional association, one must pay the dues and join. And we discussed this in committee, and again, the good chair, you know, entertained me with this, and so I have a problem with that. The second, or the third item is actually university and college courses. in which I think university and college courses play an important part. Unfortunately, I could not find except three of the state institutions, Corvallis, Klamath Falls, Klamath Falls and Corvallis, where you could go and get this continuing education. So if someone from Portland needed to do it at a university, they'd have to travel to Klamath Falls or they'd have to travel to Oregon State. The last area is, of course, online education, and I'm sure there's got to be, I didn't find any, some good online stuff, but again, the board is going to have to research this and figure out where the development money for online courses might come. And for those reasons, though, it may be a good idea, and I appreciate, again, the good chair's the good chair's comments in committee trying to ensure the board understood we should get as broad of possibility in the continuing education. I remain concerned that it will be so narrowly focused initially that it will be a hardship on the 80% of the businesses licensed by the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Schaffler, do you wish to close?
Yes, Mr. Speaker. You know, call me crazy, but I love continuing education, and I love well-trained dogs. A good bill should pass.
Those who are of the opinion the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no, and the clerk will open the voting system. Representative Clem, how do you vote? Clem votes aye. Oh, Representative Clem votes no. Representative Thatcher, how do you vote? Representative Thatcher votes aye. Representative Minnis, for what purpose do your ayes?
I'd like to change my vote to no, Mr. Speaker.
Representative Minnis changes her vote to no. House Bill 2538, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk will read the next bill.
House Bill 2650, relating to standards for items sold in schools and declaring an emergency.
Question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 2650A. Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, today we have before us the Healthy Foods for Healthy Students Act, and I'm urging your support of this bill. I'm going to run this through with you because it's a fairly complex bill, but I just want to say from the start that this is a bill that that has been knocking around the building for the last couple sessions on how do we provide nutrition standards in our schools. And what we have before us today is an excellent bill that's been worked very hard, so I hope you give it due consideration. So what the bill does, House Bill 2650 will set nutrition standards for all foods and beverages sold in schools, and that's outside the national breakfast and lunch programs. This bill establishes reasonable standards for individual entrees not sold as part of the USDA school meal. So those are those a la carte meals that we're familiar with in our schools. Snacks and beverages sold in vending machines in school stores and on the a la carte lines will have to meet nutrition guidelines. Foods will have to have a certain percentage of fat, 35% fat or less. It also talks about in the bill saturated fat and the percent of sugar by weight. Beverages will have to be in appropriate serving sizes, 8 ounces or less in elementary schools, 10 ounces in middle schools, and under 12 ounces in high schools. In elementary and middle schools, water, milk, and 100% juice can be sold. And in high schools, we'll add to that list low-calorie beverages and sports drinks that may be sold in addition to the water, milk, and 100% juice. The goal here is to not restrict selling foods, but providing healthy choices for our students when we sell items. So in other words, snacks such as 600-calorie servings of cookies would be out, but don't worry, there'll still be fun things to eat. You can have 100-calorie snack packs like this that would meet the guidelines but provide nutritional snacks for students.
Representative Kotek?
Yes,
do you
I'm
wish
sorry.
To ask for permission to use
I'm sorry, Mr. Speaker.
A visual aid?
Permission to use visual aid.
Representative Kotek asks for unanimous consent to use a visual aid. Is there objection? See none. Please use your aids.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thank you, colleagues. You can have them after. In the school stores, instead of selling candy and high-fat chips, this bill would say you'd have to sell packages of cookies, chips, and drinks that are reasonable in serving size. And I think the serving size is a really important issue. So, again, in packets like this, we're talking about reasonable sizes that will satisfy the hunger needs but not have ridiculous amounts of calories or fat in them. And then in vending machines, instead of 300-calorie sugary beverages, for example, this 20-ounce soda, you'd have reasonable-sized beverages in juice sizes, milks, and waters. So I wanted to show some examples so there's not the idea that we're somehow not going to have anything fun in our vending machines anymore. But what we're going to have are healthier choices for our students, and that's the goal of this bill. In terms of food sold in the a la carte line, the bill restricts to 450 calories and less than 26% fat. So instead of an a la carte line serving a 600-calorie plate of French fries, they will serve smaller, age-appropriate portions of French fries suitable as a side dish. Rather than large pizza slices, schools can sell smaller pizza slices. Again, healthier choices in reasonable sizes. The standards in this bill are very similar to those set by voluntary agreements entered into by the American Beverage Association and the Alliance for a Healthier Generation. And the standards are very similar to those set in some 20 other states, including California and Washington. So how do we get to this bill? It's really important that in the schools, what we sell in the schools matches what we're teaching our students. If we're going to have our health education and our nutrition classes talking about eating low-calorie, low-fat snack items, but then we sell something else, we're sending a mixed message. What this bill does is providing good modeling for the types of foods that we are selling in our schools. This bill is a result of many, many months of coalition work among parents, public health advocates, physicians, nutritionists, teachers, and administrators who have been concerned about the proliferation of unregulated junk food in the schools. Many of you will recall that 2 years ago in the last session, there was a bill passed to add wellness policies at the individual school level. Unfortunately, they did not get the job done. Less than 20% of the wellness policies in Oregon school districts enacted, they did not mention specific nutrition guidelines for snacks. Less than 20% actually mentioned nutrition. So we heard lots of concerns. Many of you will know we have went into the Dash 15 amendments on this. We had multiple public hearings, multiple work sessions. But that was because we had many stakeholder meetings before we even got to the public hearings. And we've heard from school food service directors. We've heard from parents. And we've made several compromises in this bill from the original draft. We made compromises about beverages to make sure that we could serve Oregon-grown juices. We took out some mineral and vitamin content. We made some compromises about the a la carte offerings. And I think the one that is going to be most important to a lot of you is we made a compromise about the implementation date. We realize that some schools will have difficulty getting these up and running right away. There are some schools in the state who have actually stricter standards than what is in this bill, and they've been able to do that without any great difficulty. But there will be schools that will have challenges, and so this bill will not go into effect until the 2008 school year. And there's actually a 2-year delay in implementation for a la carte food items that are prepared in the school that are sold in the school, because we know that that might take a little bit more time. Ultimately, this is about getting a handle on our childhood obesity epidemic in the state, which not only in the state but around the country. You have numerous materials before you today. There's a new report out just today on childhood obesity. This is one of the top recommendations, setting some nutrition guidelines in the schools. It's not just about eating, but it's an integral part of physical activity and eating to reduce our childhood obesity in the state. Finally, what we want is to make sure that our students really have healthy choices. And I'm supporting this bill and have worked very hard on it, because even though some school districts have already set nutrition standards, many schools have not. Every student in this state should have access to healthy choices in their schools, because every students should have a fair shake of growing up healthy, developing well, learning in schools, and what they eat is incredibly important to their success in their future. And with that, I urge your aye vote on House Bill 2650, and we have another carrier who would like to talk about his perspective on the bill. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Representative Bruin.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, first let me thank and compliment the good representative from North Portland. Her fair, thoughtful, and comprehensive leadership on this in our health committee was simply nothing short of outstanding, and that is not false praise. She did wonderful work. I've come to this idea more recently after researching similar efforts in California led by Governor Schwarzenegger, and the reasons to support improved school nutrition are numerous and have already been well articulated. But I embrace the issue of school nutrition for a very specific reason: the statewide explosion of type 2 diabetes among children. Years ago, it was unheard of that children could acquire type 2 diabetes. This type of diabetes, always called adult onset, was the purview of obese adults. Today, we know that age has much less to do with this disease than does obesity and the risk of obesity. In fact, we know that there is a direct and unmistakable correlation between obesity and diabetes. Currently, Mr. Speaker, 25% of Oregon children are overweight or obese. Oregon has seen a tripling in the obesity rate among children over the last two decades. There has also been, during this time, a similar and directly related increase in the diagnosis of type 2 diabetes in kids. It is a statewide epidemic. In fact, OHSU reports that diagnosis of type 2 diabetes in kids is overtaking the diagnosis of type 1 diabetes, always referred to as juvenile onset diabetes. Mr. Speaker, I have type 1 juvenile onset diabetes. I've had it for 26 years this month. By my calculation, I have taken approximately 29,500 shots and 59,850 stab blood tests, give or take a few. I do fine, and as has been said, from disease I have learned much which life could never have taught me in any other way. But diabetes is a ravaged disease that I would not wish on my worst enemy. The average annual medical costs for a diabetic are well over $13,000, and a child diagnosed with diabetes, type 1 or type 2, will lose, on average, 19 years of her life. Diabetes complications include heart disease, blindness, kidney disease, and amputation. It controls your life. You can never forget about it. You can never ignore it. It is painful, it is costly, and it is deadly. But today, colleagues, we can do something powerful. Today, in this age of PlayStation complacency and supersized convenience, this House can, by adopting strong nutrition standards in our schools, make a stand against a statewide health crisis. These standards will serve as a critical bulwark in our battle against obesity and type 2 diabetes. First, by adopting improved nutrition and reduced calorie standards for kids while in school, and secondly, helping to educate children on appropriate serving sizes, something they're not learning when they order the super mega meal and 64-ounce Mountain Dew at the local fast food joint. Childhood obesity and type 2 diabetes are largely preventable with proper nutrition, adequate exercise, and a pinch of common sense discipline. Toward that, House Bill 2605 is a reasoned and appropriate tool to improve the lives and health of Oregon school children. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Further discussion, Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, I rise today just to say a thank you to you. Salem-Keizer School District already does this, and you didn't have to tell them to do it. This is about, to me, being a parent, being a part of a community, and being involved in a local school district that has an option and a choice to do what they want to do. I admire and respect my colleagues that have talked about all the benefits to that, and I think the students at Salem-Keizer are probably receiving some of those benefits because local people got involved and said this is the right thing to do. I do have a problem with me telling your school district that they need to do it. I think it needs to be driven by the local level and the state. If they need support, guidelines, we certainly can supply that to them to help them ease into that transaction, so I will be a no vote today.
Further discussion, Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
You know, after sitting through all the testimony in committee, I went back and forth on this particular bill, and I still have some serious concerns. First and foremost is the notion that parents should be the ones responsible for ensuring that their kids are eating right. But we know that parents can't be there all the time. Second, given that kids spend a great portion of their day at school, we should expect more from their schools. We should expect that they are providing healthy foods for our children. I'd like to read a paragraph from the Oregon Medical Association in written testimony provided to the committee. While schools are only part of the solution to this growing problem, the potential they have to shape student behavior is great. But students spend much of their day in school. There is a unique opportunity to teach kids what a normal portion size is. Peer-reviewed research shows that school nutrition standards almost identical to House Bill 2650 lead to healthier eating choices for kids, including more consumption of fruits and vegetables. In addition, standards for food sold in vending machines in the school store are needed so that parents' efforts to teach healthy messages are reinforced in school, not undermined. Third, I'm not a big fan of piling on more state mandates on our local school districts. But there are many districts who are not providing proper nutrition for students, and perhaps this law will help them move in the right direction. As a matter of fact, when these standards were brought to the school board's attention and school districts were asked to bring their districts into compliance with these nutrition standards, only two out of the 199 districts did. Salem-Keizer is a great example. Fourth, there is a price to pay by way of moving toward better nutrition for our kids. Reading from a letter from Commissioner Jeff Kogan in Multnomah County, overweight and obese children are at higher risk of long-term health problems, including cardiovascular disease, stroke, high blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, asthma, and certain cancers. The lives of overweight youth are also affected by discrimination, bullying, stress, poor body image, and low self-esteem. Either for the health issues that we're talking about that obesity does create and the disease issues that it creates for sends children on the path as they grow older, we pay the price now by asking our schools to provide a better standard or pay the price later for in our health care system. Finally, as a mother of 5 adult children and 10 grandchildren, a couple of whom would prefer to have strawberries over cookies or broccoli over something else, that's rare, I believe this is the right direction to go, and I do urge your support. Thank you.
Representative Lim.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
We need to recognize that the obesity is a disease, has to be cured. It's like a smoking, and smoking was one of the life enjoyment in the past. Nowadays, it's considered as a mental disease, smoking. Obesity is no different to it, even more dangerous. Instead of trying to fix the symptoms, we need to go to the sources where it's coming from. To me, that the House Bill 2650 is a good bill. This is not going to solve the whole problem, but this is the right step toward it. I'd like to give you my own recipe, how to keep your body slim and healthy. That's my own way. I'm not a doctor. But that I'm going to give you from my experience. Before I do that, I'm going to give you several anecdotes I have experienced. About 2-3 weeks ago, we had nurses came to the rotunda area giving us a test the whole thing, and I was going to take the flu shot. And the nurse, a beautiful nurse, told me, oh, you have such a tiny arms. That's true compared to her. She has a double size of my arms. But let me tell you, my arms are mostly that they are muscles and bones. So, and about when I was 4 years old, I was about 135 pounds. I owned a small mom and pop grocery store. And a neighbor, big guy, about 6'2", about more than 200 pounds. I know she does not have a lot of muscles, but she got a lot of, you know, obesity, let me call it. And he's boasting how strong he is. I challenged him, are you willing to do an arm wrestle with me? And he willingly approved it. So in the counter, I did arm wrestle it. In a 2 seconds, I fold him down. So obesity doesn't necessarily mean strength. Strength is in the muscle and the bone. I'm not going to show it to you now, but if you come to my office later to check it out, I will show it to you. Okay? And let me challenge you, anyone over here, willing to arm wrestle with me, come to my office afterward. But the representative from Westland, I know he has a lot of muscle. Don't come to me to arm wrestle, because I'm going to lose it. Anyway, after having said that, this is common sense. We need a lot of physical exercise and work. Last weekend, I did yard work and plus that a couple things, about a couple hours. And that night, I slept real good. So physical exercise and work makes the person strong and healthy. That's the first, okay? And then second, eat and drink. I see a lot of children of ours, they eat, drink pops, sodas, you know. To me, water is the best. And I usually drink water. You don't see me often drinking any sodas. Occasionally, I might treat myself to a special day. Otherwise, I don't do that. The third, I want to eat some food with hot spicy. You know, I upstairs at our lounge, a lot of hot spice over there. I always ask for that. Hot spice is good, circulating the blood. And also, in addition to it, you gotta eat some Korean kimchi. That's one of the best in the world. And mostly vegetable and plus other things. Kimchi is one of the best food in the world. It is known now. And then, fourth, no smoking. This is not directly related to this house bill, just I'm telling you from the philosophically, I never smoked in my life, and I will continue to do that. So with all of those things, that philosophically I spoke to this bill, and I'm willing to support this house bill 2650A. This is a good bill to pass. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you. Further discussion, Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. Question to the carrier.
Question to the carrier. Does Carrie yield?
I do.
She does.
Thank you. If Billy says his sells his giant king-size Snicker bar to Bobby, will he be breaking state law under this bill?
Thank you for the question. This is about what schools sell, school-sanctioned selling. So I can't speak to that. I'd have to know more of the context of that. But the goal here is, what is sold outside of our federal school meal program? So that's the vending machines, that's the school stores, that's the a la carte lines. And as far as I know, I don't know what we do in that individual case, but I don't think that it's addressed in this bill. Thank you.
Okay, maybe clarification, because it does say...
Clarification, does the carrier yield?
Yes.
She does.
Because it does say food sold in school. I'm thinking if Susie brings her Girl Scout cookies to sell to her fellow students after school, she could possibly be breaking the law in that case?
Again, I don't believe that was a... We didn't bring it up. That wasn't discussed in testimony. It's not really, I don't believe, addressed in the bill. Again, this is about institutionally sanctioned selling of products in the schools. And may I add to that is really the goal of the bill, as if you read it, talks about the school boards essentially policing the school districts to adhere to these new guidelines. We're not talking about the Department of Education running around as the food police. This is about the boards and the districts working within these standards to make sure that their schools are in compliance.
Okay, follow-up question?
Further question, Ms. Kerr, you yield?
I do.
She does.
During committee testimony, was any discussion about how this bill might create an underground or black market of Twinkies and M&Ms discussed?
No, it was not.
One more question.
Additional question, Ms. Kerr, you yield?
I do.
She does.
Thank you. Does this bill require schools to teach students how to eat healthy, such as calories in, calories out, and about fats, proteins, and carbohydrates, et cetera?
Thank you. That's an excellent question. This bill does not directly address curriculum and or what is taught in the schools. However, we do have health education standards here in the state, and if we are teaching students about how to eat healthy, and I know that is part of that curriculum, what we're going to have is good modeling and good, you know, we teach them in class, eat low calorie, low fat, and they can go out and buy that product in the vending machine. That's good teaching.
To the bill.
To the bill.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think there are still a lot of unanswered questions in this bill, and in other states who have enacted similar legislation, they have actually seen a black market crop up, believe it or not. And I have two teenagers, and if you tell them they can't have something, that's just what they want. And what about open campuses? And what about school-approved fundraisers and, you know, the choirs selling cookie dough and anyway, for fundraisers? And everywhere you turn in this country, we see messages about low-carb this, low-fat this, about eating healthy in our schools. If they haven't already caught on to this, I'm not sure if more rules are going to change the atmosphere, especially if they're not preaching what they practice. If we want our kids to develop healthy habits and eat right, why aren't we requiring schools to teach proper nutrition in class? If we don't educate our kids, they'll just go home after school, pig out on the giant Snicker bar and the Cheetos and sit and play video games. It just seems like it kind of defeats the whole point of this legislation. And I also echo the comments of representative from Damascus and Clackamas that parents ought to be in the role of teaching their children, and they should take the lead when it comes to nutrition. Thanks.
Further discussion, Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I had the opportunity to serve on the Health Policy Committee that heard hours of testimony on this bill. And I began hearing the bill with some degree of skepticism, primarily because of my own commitment to the idea of local control. You'll remember that very recently I was a school board member. However, I became persuaded that the issue of obesity among children in the state of Oregon is a public health issue. And I think that we cannot ask local school districts to take on issues of public health to address those through their own policies. This is not talking about what they teach, what their curriculum is. This is simply setting a standard for what it is that will be sold through public schools. I was concerned about making it possible and practical for local school districts to be able to implement this bill. That's one of the reasons why there are changes in the implementation date from the original bill. School districts have a full year before they institute the first part of the bill, which applies only to prepackaged foods. This simply means that school districts need to purchase from vendors who are selling prepackaged foods that meet these requirements. By doing this statewide, it improves the market and the access to these types of foods and will make it less costly for school districts that are choosing to move this way to do it, because all vendors that are wanting to sell in schools will need to meet these requirements. We put off in the committee until 2009 the implementation of this for foods that are going to be prepared on site or within the local school district. This allows those districts who are ready to do this to jump forward and do it now, and to then provide technical assistance to those school districts for whom it's going to take a longer period of time. There was some conversation about what is the responsibility of parents in relation to helping their kids eat healthily, and I wholeheartedly agree with that. As a parent, my first responsibility to my children is to keep them healthy and to keep them safe. It's one of the reasons why in our house we try to pack our lunches for our children. But as all of you know, for families that are working, it's not always possible to be there in the morning to pack the lunch when the kids are young, and you want to know that they have the ability to purchase healthy foods. I talked with my children about this, assuming that they would oppose any measure that would decrease their ability to access cookies and tasty treats while they were at school. I was very surprised by my 8-year-old daughter, who was concerned that it wouldn't apply to breakfast, because she pointed out that cinnamon rolls for breakfast didn't seem very healthy. And as a vegetarian, she didn't understand why her school lunch choice is a giant dipping pretzel with cheese sauce. So she was very concerned that her friends who have to buy lunch every day because they don't have parents at home who are able to pack their lunch, that they should have some healthy choices that are available to them. So on this one, I am yielding to my daughter, who asks to have access to healthy food. I hope that in another legislative session we can come back and look at the issue of the federally provided lunches, and that Oregon does not subsidize our federally subsidized lunches. We're one of the few states that does not do that, so that we can improve those meals that are available to children, some of whom, those are the only hot and nourishing meals that they get all day long, and certainly don't have them in the summer. This is an important issue. I've been persuaded. I hope that you will be too, and that you will cast your I vote in favor of supporting our kids to have healthy foods and healthy choices when they're at school. Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you to the bill, Mr. Speaker.
For the
past three terms, I have been very vocal about unfunded mandates. I've proven to this body that our unfunded mandates on schools range from 7 to 10% of their budget. One of my schools, that would mean as much as $3 million. So it's going to seem awfully strange for me to stand here today in support of this House Bill 2650. But I just want to say what Representative... I don't know what her code is. But anyway, what the last representative just said, I want to just remind everyone that this should be truly not only a taste-good bill, but a feel-good bill, because it's my bet that one-third to as much as one-half of our children receive the only good nutrition in their lives at school. Last year in January, as I was teaching in a small school on my practicum, I was just mindful of how many little kids were not going to have an evening meal. They talk about these things. They get twice as much food if they can possibly from their neighbors. I saw this over and over again. So I want to just say that a hungry child is a difficult child to teach. A child who has malnutrition is difficult to teach. We want a positive learning environment, so let's enrich their little lives so that they can most properly learn. I'm going to bet that this bill will prevent vast disruptive conduct in our schools, because we're rid of all these unnecessary toxic foods that we should not be eating anyway. So let's just remember House Bill 2650 may be the only good nutrition a child gets each day.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Kotek, do you wish to close?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, thank you for the excellent debate on this bill. It's amazing what 4 years or 2 years can make in terms of the discussion around obesity in this country. 4 years ago, there was probably a lot of folks going, we have a problem. I don't think that's the question anymore. Many, many reports have talked about what is one key way to deal with childhood obesity, and that's taking advantage of being in the schools and having proper nutrition standards. House Bill 2650 gets us there. I want to thank all the committee who went through many hours of testimony and work session on this. It came out of committee unanimously. I want to thank all the advocates who worked on it. I also want to thank the Oregon Soft Drink Association, who's not opposing this bill because they were willing to agree to the language that voluntary standards that have been in place with the beverage industry that they're willing to have in statute here in Oregon. Local schools want local control, but we know that public health issues often trump local control. We have made public health decisions around immunization, around smoking, around bullying. Nutrition standards is a public health issue. We need to take on our obesity problem in our state. 2650 is a fabulous and very important tool for us to do that. And I urge your aye vote on this bill, and thank you for listening.
Those who are of the opinion the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. And the clerk will open the voting system. Representative Crummell, how do you vote? Crummell votes no. House Bill 2650A, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Representative Berger, for what purpose do you rise?
Mr. Speaker, I request rules be suspended and return to the order of business of courtesies.
Representative Berger requests unanimous consent to return to the order of courtesies without objection. Please go ahead.
Thank you. I have been informed that there's a group of students in the back gallery from my district, from the community school. There's about a group of high school students. They've certainly listened to an appropriate debate this morning, and I'd like you to please wave them a welcome. Thank you.
Further courtesies? Turning to the order of third reading of House bills, Chair requests unanimous consent the rules be suspended. The bills remaining in today's third reading of House bills be carried over to their proper place on Wednesday, April 4th, 2007, third reading calendar. Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Final reading, memorials, and resolutions. Clerk will read the first resolution. Just a minute. Chair requests unanimous consent that the consideration of HCR 7 be made a special order of business immediately following the order of business of special committee reports on Thursday, April 19th, 2007 calendar. Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Now I'll have the clerk read the resolution.
HCR 11 in memoriam, Michael T. Muniz, 1952 to 2006.
The question now arises upon third reading and final passage of House Concurrent Resolution 11. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, to the resolution. Colleagues, I rise today with some sadness in my heart to urge your support for House Concurrent Resolution 11, which is a memoriam to the life of Michael T. Muniz. I want to acknowledge Michael's wife, Lydia Muniz, who's over on this side aisle today. She's been patiently waiting this morning for this discussion. Lydia works as the governor's advocate for minority women in emerging small businesses. Michael was my friend and my colleague. I first met Michael in 1978, and probably some of my colleagues were in preschool. I met him when he was working as a Reggie at Lane County Legal Aid in Eugene. Reggies were recipients of the Reginald Heber Smith Community Law Fellowship, named after the founder of Legal Aid in America. They're people like Michael, who was so dedicated to public service and helping those less fortunate. And Michael spent the rest of his career doing just that. Michael Muniz earned his BA in political science from the University of California, Santa Barbara in 1974, and his law degree from Lewis and Clark Law School in 1978. A new lawyer like Michael could have gone to work just about anywhere. He had a combination of intellect, charm, ethics, and optimism. But he also had an empathy and an unwavering dedication to helping his community and everyone living in it. He started working at Legal Aid in Eugene and stayed there for a few years, then went on to other legal services programs, focusing his work on immigration, disability, farm worker rights, economic development, and senior issues. In 1989, Michael went into private practice and had an office in Portland and in Salem. Robert Donaldson, who was Michael's law partner for almost 7 years, had this to say about Michael. Michael was one of the best immigration lawyers in Oregon and certainly among the best in the United States. He was intellectually curious and had a penchant for getting the details. The result was that he was well-informed in the law, and he also made sure he knew his client's whole story. Michael was generous with his time with other lawyers. He would offer his time to help any lawyer who would contact him, and that occurred every day. Michael published several articles and became a highly respected speaker. He lectured regularly at the American Immigration Lawyers Association, including at their national convention. And following the lead of our mutual friend, former State Representative Rocky Berea, Michael went on to teach immigration law, both at the University of Oregon Law School and at Lewis and Clark Law School. In 2005, the Oregon chapter of the American Immigration Lawyers Association honored Michael with the Gerald Robinson Excellence in Advocacy Award in recognition of his outstanding and tireless advocacy of immigrant rights. Although I did not see Michael much after we worked together so many years ago, I know that he was incredibly devoted and close to his family. He and Lydia were founding members of Scholarships for Oregon Latinos, which helps provide post-secondary educational opportunities. He inspired many. At his memorial service in Salem this past fall, Michael's brother Matthew shared this story. A few years ago, Michael was in Portland working on a case, and a young woman came up to him and said, "You don't remember me, but you were my family's lawyer when I was a little girl, and you are the reason I am an American now. I was so impressed with you that I decided I wanted to help other families, and because of you, I'm now in my third year of law school." Oregon Supreme Court Chief Justice Paul DeMunis stated this about Michael. Quote, "He was a wonderful human being. He was a person who walked his talk. He believed in service to man. He believed in service to the community. And he believed in legal aid service that he participated in for a good bit of time. He was the kind of lawyer who demonstrates what legal aid is all about, and for Michael, being a lawyer was not just a job, it was a calling. Michael Muniz and his contributions to our state will be greatly missed. I urge you to join me in honoring the life and career of Michael Muniz by adopting House Concurrent Resolution 11. Thank you.
Further discussion of the resolution? Seeing none, Representative Bonamici, do you wish to close?
No, thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Those who are of the opinion that the resolution should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. And the clerk will open the voting system. Representative Boquist, how do you vote? Representative Boquist? Representative Boquist is off the floor. House Concurrent Resolution 11, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Bills, reports, and other business lying on the table. First reading of Senate bills.
Senate Bill 5546 relating to State Financial Administration, declaring an emergency. Senate Bill 36 relating to Oregon Inpatient Safety Commission, declaring an emergency. Senate Bill 85 relating to utility attachment. Senate Bill 144 relating to medical imaging. Senate Bill 880 relating to treatment of pain.
Bills read first time or passed the Speaker's desk for referral. Second reading of Senate bills. Third reading of Senate bills. Chair requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended and that the bills remaining on today's third reading of Senate bills be carried over to their proper place on Wednesday, April 4, 2007, third reading calendar. Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Other business of the House. Other business of the Senate. Orders of the day have been completed. Announcements. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. A reminder to House Republicans, rally on the steps and then a short caucus in about 15 minutes.
Further announcements? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Democrats will caucus at 12:30.
Remonstrances? Representative Galizio.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. You know, a famous quote says, publicity is like power. It's a rare man who isn't corrupted by it. And I have in my hand here a front page article that has no fewer than 15 photographs of Mr. Obi Rutledge. And I'm really concerned that this kind of publicity might have a detrimental effect, and I hope I'm wrong. So thank you.
Obi, we are all very honored to be associated with you, and certainly enjoyed reading the article today. Thank you, Obi. Further remonstrances? Adjournment. Representative Jensen, 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, April 4th, 2007.
Mr. Speaker, I move the House adjourn until 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, April 4th, 2007.
Representative Jensen moves the House adjourn until 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, April 4th, 2007. Without objection, the House is adjourned.